TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fukushima Symposium 2013, Joseph Mangano, Post-Fukushima Increases in Thyroid Disease in Newborns, on the west coast of the USA. On March 7, 2013, an article was published in the Open Journal of Pediatrics. Co-written by Joe Mangano and Jeanette Sherman, it stated that in the first 15 weeks after the fallout from Japan arrived in the U.S., the number of newborns with hypothyroid disease increased by 28% on the West Coast, while declining by 3% in the rest of the country. Joe Mangano presented this report at the March 2013 Fukushima Symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine. Mangano is the executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project. He's a public health administrator and researcher. The Radiation and Public Health Project was founded 25 years ago by well-known critics of the nuclear age, such as Jay Gould, Benjamin Goldman, and Ernest Sternglass. They and current staff believe that there's a growing body of medical and scientific evidence of a link between low-level internal radiation and worldwide increases in immune deficiency diseases. They especially point to cancer and diseases affecting the newborn. The Radiation and Public Health Project has assembled much of the epidemiological evidence documenting these links on their website, radiation.org. Here's Joe Mangano, recorded on March 12, 2013, at the two-day Fukushima Symposium, organized by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility.
The first thank you goes to Helen Caldicott. Who put on the symposium, which is a staggering task, and who was kind enough to invite me to present. So again, Helen, thank you so much. My topic is going to be about the article that was published 5 days ago in the Open Journal of Pediatrics about the changes in newborn hypothyroidism in the United States after Fukushima. But first, let me give you just a 30-second thumbnail about the group I work with, for those of you who don't know. Radiation Public Health was founded in 1989. We are an organization independent of government and of industry. We consist of health professional scientists, and we work with citizens, and our mission is to publish medical journal studies and to present these findings to the public on the health risks of exposure to fission products. To that end, we have the one I'm talking about today will be number 31. We have a 32nd coming up later this month. There's no stopping here. And we've also done 8 books. Most recent one here is called Mad Science, published by OR Books last fall, and I urge you all to go online and take a look at it if you're interested. Before I go into the actual mechanics and results of the study, I think it's very critical, and we have to understand not just the X's and O's of the research we're doing, we have to understand the context of which we're doing it, okay? Yes, there is challenges. There are challenges in calculating dose. In fact, calculating an exact dose is impossible. The best we can do is an estimate. And there are challenges in collecting data on harm, on changes in health status and changes in disease and death rates for a variety of reasons. So these are things that we have to deal with. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that the greatest challenge that we in the research community face is one of corruption. Corruption of the objective scientific method, okay? from the very beginning, from the literally the second that the Fukushima meltdown began, there was a rush to judgment by a number of people and organizations in authority, the Japanese government, TEPCO, the IAEA, the World Health Organization, to absolutely minimize this disaster, which everyone acknowledges was either the worst or the second worst disaster in nuclear history. This was not some small leak near a nuclear plant in some isolated area. And what the rush to judgment is the people immediately jump to the conclusion that these doses are very, very low and very small amounts get in people's bodies, and that there is no way that humans can be harmed or the harm is going to be very, very minimal. Assumptions like this absolutely make hash of the scientific process, of the objective process in examining topics like this. The worst thing about it is some of these groups are very high profile, all right? They report this information to the media, and the media reports it to the public. And they report it again and again, and the public begins to believe this, okay, even before any studies are done. In fact, there's one comment by a gentleman, by Dr. John Boyce from Vanderbilt University, who said not only are the doses are so, so low, there's no way any epidemiological study could detect any increase in any disease from Fukushima. So in other words, put your pencils away, everybody. Don't do any studies. It is up to us in the more objective areas of the research community to stand up to this. We need to, first of all, conduct studies immediately, as soon as we can. We need to use whatever data we have, even though it's going to take decades and decades to really find out what the full meaning of Fukushima was. We have to start now. And most importantly, we have to get this information out into the public so that they understand we're not dealing with a small leak here. We're dealing with an extremely serious situation. The article we did is actually our second article on Fukushima health effects. I'm the co-author with my colleague, Dr. Janet Sherman, who is an esteemed internist and toxicologist. We picked the topic newborn hypothyroidism. And for those of you who don't know, hypothyroidism is a condition where the level of thyroid hormone is very low and the gland is underactive. When this occurs in newborns, it can do great harm to any physical and mental development. It's screened for by every state in the United States for the last several decades to identify these people and to put them on thyroid hormone immediately to avoid some of these terrible consequences. Two elements made up our paper. Number one was dose. Again, no such thing as a perfect dose. But we used EPA data on what we call gross beta. In other words, all radioactive elements that emit beta particles, including radioactive iodine, which attacks the thyroid gland. And we also used whatever the EPA data came up with on iodine-131. This was very poor. They only had something like 77 readings of I-131 in precipitation until two months later, they said, we don't need to accelerate any monitoring. We're going back to once every 6 months, which is just a terrible, terribly poor decision on their part. We know hypothyroidism is something that's sensitive to radiation, to iodine. We've seen it before, and we've documented it in our paper. Experiments on rats years ago, people in the South Pacific exposed to atomic bomb fallout, people living downwind from Three Mile Island, and people from and after the Chernobyl accident, all showed increased levels, rates of hypothyroidism. And we also know that the fetus and the newborn are far, far more sensitive than adults to a particular dose of radiation. So this, not to mention the fact that we didn't have much data to choose from at this early date, we feel hypothyroidism is a good disease entity to start with. Unfortunately, I had to call up all 50 states' newborn screening programs. I yearn for the day when this country has three states instead of 50. 41 states responded. We found that the five states on the West Coast and the Pacific, California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii, tended to have the highest levels of not just gross beta that we found, but other researchers have found high levels in kelp and in soil and air as well. So we compared the changes, the 2010, 2011 changes in the cases of newborn hypothyroidism, for these five states versus the rest of the country, the other 36 states for which we had data. We found the following. We found that in the first 15 weeks after the fallout from Japan arrived in the United States, the number of newborn hypothyroid cases increased 28% on the West Coast, and for the rest of the year, the last 9 months, increased 16.5%. This is compared to the rest of the country in which we saw a 3% decline. The differences are statistically significant, although we do point out in the article that these aren't a huge number of cases. In a single year in the United States, something like 2,200 or so newborn hypothyroid cases are detected. Now, I'm going to get back to why this is important. This study is certainly not an ending to the research effort for Fukushima. It is very much a beginning. It is a very basic study, all right? But we make very clear that not only are there limits to this study, which any good author will do, but there are things we should be doing in the future. More studies on thyroid conditions, such as hypothyroidism, and more studies of other conditions of the fetus and the infant, stillbirths, infant deaths, perinatal deaths, birth defects, cancer in infants, low weight births and premature births among them. These 2011 data haven't been published yet in the U.S., but within the next few months they will. And again, we need to use these and conduct studies. We need to publish them. We need to do it promptly. And, as I said, we need to bring it to the public. And this is just the United States, by the way. I mean, the same sort of thing should be going on in Japan, and we're looking into ways to work with Japanese researchers to do this kind of work. You know, it's very, very easy to forget what we're studying. I find this every so often I have to remind myself of this. I get very caught up in my pencils and my calculators and my papers and so on. We're talking about human beings here. We're talking about vulnerable fetuses in pregnant women. We're talking about infants and young children and elderly people whose immune diseases are failing and people with immune conditions and people in general. And these people have been harmed in Japan and near Fukushima especially, but in other countries as well. They have absorbed these poisons, and we need to remember that. Because, especially if we're seeing hints that low-dose radiation in the United States here may have harmed it, we are looking at the possibility of all 104 reactors in this country having the ability to do the same thing. Not just with meltdowns, but with routine emissions. We've seen this happen before on Three Mile Island. Within 12 years after the accident, there were no medical journal articles that were published on cancer before and after the accidents. Okay, it wasn't until 12 years after, and by that time, 31 articles had been published in journals like Psychosomatic Medicine and Trauma and Stress. 31 of them, all dealing with Three Mile Island and all discussing the stress issues. The silence was deafening. Finally, a group from Columbia University put out a study. They found that near Three Mile, within the first 5 years, the number of cancer cases went up 64%, and they concluded that radiation was not linked to it. It was not linked to this increase, and they suggested stress. And that, several years later, Steve Wing and his colleagues in North Carolina put out a wonderful paper showing just the opposite. But by then, it was 18 years after the accident, and the mantra, nobody died at Three Mile Island, nobody died at Three Mile Island, nobody died at Three Mile Island, was heard again, and it is still heard today by people in authority. Same thing happened with Chernobyl. Soon afterwards, when the firefighters got rid of the fire and covered the damaged reactor, 31 liquidators absorbed high doses of radiation and died very quickly. And boy, if I had a dime for every time I heard the number 31. Only 31 people died at Chernobyl. Only 31 people died at Chernobyl. And this is while, you know, mass suffering was being reported in the Ukraine and Belarus and Russia and elsewhere. And it wasn't until 2009 when this terrific book by Alexei Yablokov, who's one of our speakers here, was put out. His estimate, based on 5,000 reports, was 985,000 deaths worldwide. That was 9 years ago. He just told me at the break that the number has grown ever since. So that is my final word to you. We need to be vigorous as a research community in getting these studies done with using whatever data possible and getting it to the public. Otherwise, as Santa Anna said, we're doomed to repeat history. Thank you very much.
That was Joseph Mangano, the Executive Director of the Radiation and Public Health Project at radiation.org. Studies available at their website suggest that cancer rates are higher for people living near nuclear power plants and decrease after a power plant is shut down. The Radiation and Public Health Project is also involved in a study that used to be carried out by the federal government. They test baby teeth for strontium 90 and are actively collecting them near nuclear facilities. Radioactive strontium 90 is one of the deadliest of the elements released. Their chemical structure is so similar to that of calcium that the body gets fooled and deposits strontium 90 in the bones and teeth, where it remains for life, continually emitting cancer-causing radiation. The article Joe Mangano cited in this talk was co-written by him and Dr. Jeanette Sherman, a fellow researcher with the Radiation and Public Health Project. Sherman publishes and lectures in the field of toxicology and is currently adjunct professor of environmental studies at Western Michigan University. Since Mangano did not have time to quote from the article in great detail, I'll present some more of the interesting findings in the remainder of this radio program. Anybody following the Fukushima accident closely remembers that the prevailing media beat was that the releases were small and far away and of little concern, even if they were to get to the U.S. The Mangano-Sherman article, however, suggests that airborne radiation disseminated worldwide from the meltdowns at Fukushima, beginning on the day of the accident on March 11, 2011. Just 4 days after the meltdowns, iodine-131 concentrations in U.S. precipitation was measured up to 211 times above normal, and the highest levels of airborne gross beta that includes iodine-131 were documented by our very own Environmental Protection Agency in the 5 U.S. states on the Pacific Ocean. That's Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. The EPA data show that on the Pacific West Coast, exposure was 7,345 times higher in the March 15-April 30 period, compared to just 2,397 times in the other sites. And among the California sites, some received radiation doses that were way off the charts. Those are the cities of Eureka, with an increase of 38,264, Anaheim near Los Angeles, 14,941, and San Bernardino, 12,054. The lowest increases for all of the U.S. were found in the southeastern cities of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, 1,222 times, and Montgomery, Alabama, 1,212. Mangano and Sherman's report also quotes a national study conducted by the National Geological Survey. Between March 15 and April 5, 2011, they examined concentrations of wet depositions of iodine-131, cesium-134, and 137. Results showed that for iodine-131, the highest depositions occurred in northwest Oregon, 5,100, central California, 1,600, and that's prime agricultural land, in northern Colorado, 833, coastal California, where TUC Radio is, 211, and western Washington, 60.4. No other stations recorded concentrations above 13. So Mangano and Sherman make the point that radiation did arrive, and in their opinion continues to arrive, and should be more closely monitored, and that it did have an immediate, not a delayed effect. They and others in this radio series repeat one point that has been neglected up to now. There is increasing evidence that radiation affects children and women disproportionately more, and the unborn children are the most vulnerable and need to be protected. One of the strong points of the U.S. public health system is that every baby at birth gets tested for several conditions, among them hypothyroidism. To have these data available for decades now allows researchers to discover trends. And one, sadly, is the increase of cases of this serious and potentially deadly condition. Hypothyroidism, when the level of thyroid hormone is very low and the gland is underactive, has serious impacts on physical and mental development. But if detected early, it can be treated with hormones. And thousands of children and adults are treated around Chernobyl today. There is, of course, controversy about the causes of the increase. Radiation and public health say the rise of hypothyroidism has to do with the dissemination of radioactive iodine through the atmospheric bomb tests, the nuclear accidents, and the fact that nuclear power plants in their daily operation are allowed to emit a whole range of radioactive elements into air and water. Supporters of the nuclear industry claim that the levels are too low to have an effect. So here, in the case of Fukushima, Mangano and Sherman saw the opportunity to use the government's own data to make the case that there is an effect at low levels and that there is no safe dose. Mangano and Sherman write that for decades, radioactive iodine has been recognized to cause adverse effects to the thyroid gland, including hypothyroidism. The thyroid, as we are learning, is of extraordinary importance for the development and maintenance of life. It is the first glandular structure to appear in the human embryo and begins to concentrate iodine and produce thyroid hormones by the 70th day of gestation. Incapable of distinguishing between beneficial iodine and radioactive iodine-131, the fetus absorbs the deadly poison. Much of it comes to the unborn by food eaten by the mother. Most dangerous is milk from cows that grazed on pasture that was hit by iodine-131, radioactive rains. As Mongano and Sherman make the time-space and a beginning of a cause-and-effect argument, they urge for this work to be continued, especially on Fukushima, since the numbers of observed cases are still small. Radioactive releases at the Fukushima reactors continue to this day and far into the future. Levels in Japan are thousands of times higher and must be monitored. Like Chernobyl, this is an obligation and an opportunity to learn from our collective mistakes. Take a look at Mangano and Sherman's 7-page article for the full context. A link is on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Follow the rich documentation referenced in 52 footnotes. Joseph Mangano was recorded on March 12, 2013, at the New York Academy of Medicine. The Fukushima Symposium presented 2 days of medicine, environmental science, and nuclear engineering related to the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. The 2-day event in March 2013 was organized by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. There you will also find the other segments of the Fukushima Symposium radio series, as well as a link to the streaming video of these presentations. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD of this program by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 or write us at Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.